Hello, and welcome to another episode of Alec Mappa Hot Mess with Matthew Dempsey, psychotherapist. I'm Alec Mappa. I'm an actor and comedian. I live in Hollywood, and I've experienced a great deal of trauma.
And I can't wait to dive into that. I'm Matthew Dempsey, and I'm a multicultural counselor and psychotherapist.
We're talking today about near-death experiences. Let's jump right in. And I mentioned
right before the show
that you were hit by a car on Sunset Boulevard when you first came to Los Angeles. And you just got up as if nothing happened.
Yeah, that's true. I did just tell this story not too long ago on our show, but yes, it was actually Santa Monica and Crescent, and I was just crossing the street, you know, only looking one way, and of course the car was coming from the other way, and it just screeched to a halt right as I got to turn my head and look at it, and I got flung up onto the car, thrown into the windshield, cracked the entire thing and rolled off, and I was lucky. Nothing happened. But
nothing
I was also in a state of shock. Yeah, nothing. Nothing. I was like, am I dead? I was just standing there, actually. And I was just like, I didn't know what happened. I'm just like, what happened? I'm like, did that just happen? So I didn't know what to do. So I just squatted. I was like, this seems like an appropriate action to take right now. I just squatted. Yeah. And then that was it. But I was unfazed.
Whenever I'm in a state of shock, I squat immediately. Do you consider that a near-death experience?
Not entirely, because it didn't, I don't know, it all happened so quickly, I suppose. I could have died, so for sure, a near-death experience. It didn't really feel as traumatic for me, but the one thing that I will say is the way, and this is something that I'm very aware of for myself, is that the way that I have coped with maybe not necessarily trauma, but a lot of difficult issues in my life and bullying and family issues, just my automatic tendency that I'm sure I learned at a very early age was how to detach. So in that moment, I'm not surprised that I actually wasn't super fazed by the fact that I got hit by a fucking car, because that's my automatic kind of trauma response, is to just kind of like freeze.
Wow. Well, my automatic response is to attach and to take everything personally. And to
what's an example?
Make it all about me. Well, you know, well, when you don't text back right away, I'm always going, he hates me. Like,
you're projecting. Sometimes you never respond.
I know. Sometimes I'm the one who doesn't respond. I just finished filming a pilot, and I texted one of the executive producers who didn't get back to me. And I immediately went to, I've been fired. I bypassed, he's not happy with me or I did something wrong to, I've been fired, with absolutely no empirical evidence. But like, that's why he hasn't gotten back to me, because there's something happening behind the scenes that, you know, that has. And then they told me that the pilot tested well and the audiences really liked me and that I'm insane.
Great.
But that's me. That is my people pleasing trauma. That is my awfulizing. I do that. Which the Lexapro takes the edge off of, you know, because before Lexapro, I would just spiral into complete despair. Not only am I fired, but I'm never going to work again and everybody hates me. But I did have a near death experience in Mexico when I was a kid.
What happened?
We were in Mazatlan, and my sister and I had swam further out than we were supposed to in the tide. And at one point the tide came in and it rose higher than we were two little kids, and my sister was struggling, and I remember like thinking, oh, my parents are gonna kill me if something happens to her because I'm responsible. So I was under the water holding her waist up and just trying to walk in. Does that make sense?
Wow.
Walk in. And as I was walking in, I was swallowing more and more water. And then another wave came, and I kept on pushing her in front of me. And at one point my head bobbed up and my vision changed. I actually saw a fast forward of my life. You know how they say that your life flashes before your eyes?
Yes.
It was like the fastest fast forward of my 10 years on Earth. I don't know what that was. Wow. I still can't explain it to anybody. It is such a it's such a phrase that is just part of the lexicon, such a familiar phrase. Your life flashes before your eyes. And that actually happened, but it happened when I was a kid. I've had two times where a car came this close to hitting me.
Oh, really?
When I was crossing Haight Street when I was in high school, I was completely stoned and I wasn't looking and I walked right into a street and a car screeched out in front of me. And stopped, you know, and screeched to a halt. Like it was, I would have been dead. No, I would not have recovered like Matthew Dempsey at all.
Yeah. Well, and thank God. Thank God nothing happened to you there.
Yeah. And then another time I was in London, the same thing, crossing the street. You know how you look, they drive the wrong way.
Yeah.
And it just almost hit by a car. My life didn't flash before my eyes in those two things, but they were really things where I could have eaten it.
Well, listen, thankfully you're doing pretty well in the streets, but in the ocean, it's a different story. But what's interesting about the ocean story, too, is that in a moment where there's, you know, this kind of like near crisis that's happening, that your immediate response to it was to put your own life in danger and just to make sure that your sister was okay, because you're also worried, like specifically the thought that was there was, I don't want my parents to be upset with me. It wasn't even automatically like, I need to make sure that my sibling is okay. It's, I just don't want my parents to be upset with me. So
yeah, no, I was completely thinking of myself.
Yes. And then the kind of automatic response of caretaking, where you're putting other people's needs ahead of your own, even your own inability to breathe at that time.
Right. Right. But it's interesting how people take kind of these traumas and it either, I don't know, you know, the near death things or really scary things that happen to us. We're left to process those for the rest of our lives. Like certainly like my kid's trauma of being in foster care, that's going to be with him for the rest of his life. All I can do, I can't take that away ever. I can just give him the tools to process it and the space to grieve and the space to unpack.
That's the biggest thing. That's for any of our issues through life, is that we have an opportunity to be able to process through them, to unpack them, become familiar with them, to have tools to be able to heal in a lot of ways. There's probably always going to be some remnants of that, like echoes of these things that happen in our lives. But we absolutely have an opportunity to be able to make some headway on that stuff. And I think that's the important part, because for so long, too, we really don't talk about this stuff. This is why I love doing this podcast, is because we're actually bringing conversation to some of these things that so many people don't talk about and historically really haven't talked about, where it's like things happen to you, like pick yourself up by your bootstraps and you just march forward. There's no real insight and perspective on what's actually going on in our brains, right? Like it's not just kind of like, oh, feelings and emotions. It's like, no, we're talking about real chemical things that are happening in our brains and in our bodies too. And being able to have some awareness of the science there and the capacity for neuroplasticity, which is the ability for our brains to adjust and shift and change, like actual new neural pathways that can be carved out so we can have new paths of thought that also impact the way that our bodies function and our experiences and our mood and all that stuff. These things are real stuff that we have a chance to adjust so that we then can heal. So we don't have to experience these things as traumatically over and over again.
Neuroplasticity.
Neuroplasticity, yes.
I like the sound of that, because my thing, my childhood trauma was always like that I'm working on now as in my going into my 50s is the course correction of a gay kid. I have to be perfect. I have to be amazing.
Yep.
I have to achieve in order to be lovable. That is why my affirmation is I'm not so bad. That I'm worth loving and worth engagement. Well, we're so excited here at the Hot Mess Podcast because we have one of our greatest entertainers the world has ever known with us today. We have Miss Judy Garland from the dead. No, I'm kidding. We have Miss Coco Peru.
Yay.
Who is amazing. And we're so excited to talk to her. So we'll be right back with Miss Coco Peru.
There are over 90,000 people missing at any time, and over 500,000 are reported missing every year. And that's just in the United States. I'm Mike Morford.
And I'm Jess Betancourt. And in our podcast, Missing Persons, we discuss cases of people who have gone missing under mysterious circumstances. And we're joined in each episode by guests who are either related to the missing person, investigating their disappearance, or advocating for answers in the case.
Missing Persons is available everywhere you listen to podcasts, and there are dozens of episodes to binge on right now. Subscribe today so you don't miss an episode.
We are so excited to talk to our guest today. She has a 30-year career in drag, long before drag was mainstream, of course. You've seen her in film and TV, and she's toured the world with her one-person show.
Now a new generation knows her through her amazing YouTube videos, where she has over 9 million views. She's a dear friend of mine. I can't wait to talk to her. Please welcome to the program, Miss Coco Peru. Yay!
Hello, yay! My darling. I'm thrilled that you finally asked me. And this is going to be basically a free therapy session for me.
Let's do it.
Fantastic. Yeah. Fantastic. I went to see you at the West Beth Theater in New York City years ago,
before you moved to Los Angeles,
where you talked about a near-death experience and the people in it. You talked about it in such graphic detail that it was fascinating and terrifying at the same time. Not just for you reliving it on stage, but for us as the audience members. Can you walk us through that?
I know why I did that. Back then I was just much more experimenting, and I've always been fascinated with storytelling and spoken word. And so I was thinking, I wonder how people will receive a story about my accident with some really graphic details that's just spoken word, as opposed to the really graphic stuff we see on television and in film. Mm. And what amazed me was that people had a variety of experiences with that story, from being completely horrified and even angry that I did it, to other people passing out. This one girl had to run out of the room because she got diarrhea. And so I said, I'm gonna put that in one of my quotes. I laughed, I cried, I shit my pants.
That was her reaction. She had diarrhea.
Yes, she got diarrhea. And then other people thought it was completely the most beautiful thing they had ever heard, because it put them so in touch with their own life and their own vulnerability. And it took them out of their body in some weird way. So it was interesting how just a spoken word about something horrifying could really evolve. And I could hear crackling in the room. The energy was so intense.
Coco, I'm just curious, for those of us who actually don't know the full story, would you mind sharing us the near-death experience?
When I was 16, I was getting ready that evening. My parents had gone out for the evening, and I was getting into the shower to prepare for a high school production of Oklahoma, in which I was playing chorus member. And I somehow either passed out or slipped backwards in the shower and ended up going through a glass shower door. It wasn't the actual door, it was a wraparound thing. And I landed on the glass that was sticking up. So I severed 2.5 nerves in my left leg, and then as I was laying there, the glass started to fall all over. So I was basically cut up. But
lacerated.
What was so amazing was that I was lacerated. But I was very fortunate, because I found out later that if the glass had been about an inch longer, the piece that I landed on, it would have cut my entire leg off. So I was there were so many little things where I got so lucky. So when I stood up, what was amazing was that I was looking around the shower thinking, who is screaming like that? And I can look back now and say that I hear someone making noises.
I think it's Alex's dog.
It's my dog. Hold on 1 second.
It sounds but I wasn't going to say anything, because
I hate to say it, but I thought, like, I'm telling this really horrifying story and someone's like getting off to it.
No, it's like, Alex's dog snoring.
Someone's totally masturbating while I'm talking about dying.
Please keep this in the podcast. My dog is fast asleep. I just put a blanket over her. She was snoring and I didn't think anybody could hear it. All right.
Alex's dog's off and making an appearance on the show.
My near-death experience, and I'm getting upstaged by a dog.
By a
Tweety. This is the story of my life, my darling.
I know. Terrible.
Anyway, where were we? Blood, gore?
Blood, gore. Who was that?
Somebody was screaming.
So Yeah. So who is that screaming? And I was home alone. I had to get to this. I was on the third floor of our home, which was the converted attic. And I had to get to the second floor to the phone. And it was when I was at the phone that I knew I was dying. Ooh. And because I was losing so much blood.
Yes. And, now, what when you're dying, when you said you knew you were dying, was it like an intellectual thing or was it a physical feeling like I am dying?
Yeah, good question.
I felt it was a physical thing because I could literally feel the life draining out of me. Mm-hmm. I also knew, and then the other, it's amazing that this is all upon reflecting upon it, but when I look back, I can see how the mind and the body separated and each were doing what they needed to do in order to survive. So for instance, I was still embarrassed about being found dead naked. And so I thought, I've got to get to my parents' bedroom to put on a pair of my father's underwear so that when they find me dead, I won't be naked. Like, wow. I was still worried about that.
Yeah.
Like,
the social convention
back then.
Yeah.
So I get to my parents' bedroom and they have this big mirror in their bedroom. And I remember looking into the mirror. But in order for my body to survive this accident, it was in my mind was immediately erasing the reflection. So I was looking in the mirror, but unable to see my reflection. Because I think my mind knew that if I saw myself, that would be the end.
Yeah.
And so I got to the front door. I managed to open. I had called an ambulance and a neighbor, and my neighbor tied a tourniquet around my leg. And that's what saved my life. And then I was rushed to the hospital, and it was in the hospital that where I did die from the loss of blood. And, but they brought me back.
You were pronounced dead at some point.
Well, I don't think they pronounced me dead, but they knew that my brother had looked in on me because he was a police officer and they had called him in. And so when he had, the doctors had stepped out for a moment and he happened to look in, my eyes had rolled back into my head. So they came rushing back in to bring me back. And so it, I was told that, oh, you, we lost you for a little bit there. You know, that's the way I was told.
I remember that part of the story is, you told it when you said it live that the nurses on the floor referred to you as, oh, you were the boy that died.
There was one nurse that was, I think she was from possibly the Caribbean, and she was very superstitious. And she was very curious that this young kid had this near-death experience. So when I woke up from it, she was sitting by my bedside with a bowl of fruit that she had put together for me. And she... It was very weird, but in a beautiful way. And she asked me, tell me what you saw. You know, she wanted to know if I had seen anything.
Had you?
During that time I was. I didn't see anything. I can only describe the experience as I forgot who I was. But the only reason I know that I forgot who I was because I remembered who I was. Does that make sense?
How so? Like, in what ways did you?
Well, I was just experiencing peace and just very present with that peace. And then all of a sudden, as they started to bring me back, I thought, oh, I know who I, like, I remembered who I was. And I remember thinking, I'm not going back. And then all of a sudden, I like opened my eyes. And as soon as I opened my eyes, I think part of that being human, then I immediately was flooded with fear and the will to survive again.
Oh,
but for that time that I was dead, I didn't have that desire at all. So that would be the only...
It sounds to me as if your brain was in survival mode with the accident and what was happening. Like it was doing... It sounds to me as if it was doing everything it could to kind of put some distance between you and the actual physical event. When you said it was like, who is that screaming? And when you say it erased the reflection in the mirror, it almost sounds as if like what people who've been in war experience, hysterical blindness, like what they see is almost too painful to look at. And so their body literally goes blind. Have you heard of that, Matthew?
I mean, just in general, yes, the way that the ways that our brains cope in a moment where there's actual real trauma, a lot of times it's to disassociate. and so then, you know, having a bit of a buffer between kind of the reality and then what we're experiencing inside, whether that's like blacking out or whether that's like, a, you know, experiencing maybe like some kind of euphoria, but a disconnect from the physical world, those kinds of things as a way of protecting the kind of psychological functioning.
Did you have as much clarity on this accident after immediately after it was over while you were recovering in the hospital? Did you have this amount of clarity of objective, like I remember the events?
No. It was very clear. Yes. It was so clear to me. And I will say this, the other thing that I remember when I woke up from the surgery to save my leg, I was so weak and so drained, but I opened my eyes and I could see my parents standing by me and they were just blurry, but I knew who they were. Mm. And I felt my soul or whatever you want to call it, literally just soar up and out of me. Mm-hmm. It was as if I was just screaming, I'm alive. You know, I realized I had made it, you know?
Yeah. Yes.
But I was so weak that I couldn't even manage a smile. Mm-hmm. But internally it was like a party was going on. Mm. And, that was amazing, that feeling. This is all stuff I processed, but what I will say, I said something very strange that when the doctors referred to, while I was in the hospital, they referred to this as my accident. And I blurted out, I don't think it was an accident. And I thought, oh, what a weird thing to say. But I felt like something had changed inside of me. And yet I didn't have the words or the knowledge or anything, but I had a sense. Mm-hmm. And I can now look back. And so when I look back at my life, I felt normal as a young kid. And it was about in kindergarten where I started to realize I was different. Mm-hmm. People now have language for it, non-binary. I didn't have a language for what I was going through, no role models. So it was very scary to feel myself. I'm me. And then all of a sudden, little by little, start to realize that who you are is wrong. It's disappointing people. It's scaring people. And then around second grade is when I started the daily being made fun of. I was also always asked, are you a girl or a boy? They could never figure me out. And then I would say about the fourth grade is when the abuse got really mean and where it was no longer a curiosity of like, what, why are you different or what? Now it was just, I was bullied basically.
Yeah. It was to
and
shut you
so
down.
So I would look, so I decided, I was in public school at that time. So I left fifth grade and transferred to Catholic school because I thought the kids there would be nicer because they were Catholic and they were closer to the church. And my first day at school, I realized I've made a terrible mistake because they were even worse. And I would figure out different ways to walk to school to try and avoid people that bullied me. And I lost my education. I went from being an A student to barely passing. I could study for hours and not absorb any information. And my way to survive was to be funny and to live in a complete fantasy world of becoming famous. Because I think in some weird way, I thought being famous would validate me and make me special. And I would show them that I was special.
Yep.
And, but the accident was sort of, I also had some bad experiences within the church with a certain priest who I laugh about it now because it is truly ridiculous.
Can you tell us that line about in your show, the things you were offended by? I wasn't offended that I was.
I was fooling around, experimenting with a boy in my neighborhood, probably when I was about 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. And of course we were being told that sex is a sin and all this. So I had all this stuff about that. And so I went to confession. Mm-hmm. And I confessed that I was doing this with this other boy. And the next thing, my mother got a phone call from that priest. And I thought he was telling on me because mm-hmm. I could hear her saying his name. And then she got off the phone, was like, this is wonderful. He invited you and your friend to go to the YMCA. And you know, he had bought Speedo bathing suits for us because our bathing suits weren't, you needed to wear special bathing suits to go in this pool. And I realized later that the reason they were see-through when they got wet was because he had cut the lining out of them. Then he posed us naked and in these bathing suits and took photos, and you know, he had an erection and it would brush up against us and just things like that. I mean, it never got beyond that. But I remember sitting in his car and thinking, I have corrupted this man.
Right.
My evil sin of being attracted to boys made him behave this way. So this is true. But I forgave him because I got to a place in my life where I realized he's probably a victim too. He grew up in a time where he could not be openly gay. Mm. He was probably thought the only way I'll ever succeed is in the priesthood. And his sexuality was arrested at mm-hmm. a very young age. So of course, who's he going to be attracted to? Other boys that age. Mm-hmm. And so I looked at it as like, I actually had kind of empathy for this man. Mm-hmm. And, the only thing that makes me laugh is that years later I was on a cruise and I was talking to this guy and he was saying how from eighth grade throughout high school, he had the most amazing, wonderful sex with his hot Italian gym teacher. Mm. And I was so bitter because I thought, I got the fucking ugly priest. I'm not so bothered.
Yeah.
I'm not so bothered that it was inappropriate. I'm bothered that he was ugly.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, you know, so,
yes.
But you know, you mentioned earlier the detachment from mm-hmm. this. When I did go to therapy in New York years ago, my therapist would sit there with like tears in his eyes, listening to me tell stories. Mm-hmm. And I felt absolutely nothing.
Yes.
I was so detached from what I was saying to him. It was like I was a monotone robot, just rattling off these experiences. But my way of dealing has always been to sort of deal with it through humor and sort of celebrate the ridiculousness of it and then try to create a world in which that doesn't happen and try to have real conversations about we create monsters. That priest that did that to me was not born a monster. Mm. He was created, you know, through homophobia and his own internalized homophobia and his sexuality being arrested. And so all of this stuff that was happening to me, the bullying, not feeling loved, the not being accepted at the church, all this stuff, I realized early on the world is not a safe place. And then my accident really just brought it into my body. And yet I had this feeling of, like I said, it not being an accident because all of a sudden, little by little, and I mean little by little, I started to heal by realizing that I had survived something that a lot of other people would maybe not have. Mm-hmm. And also, the kids that still picked on me, even after my accident, by calling me R2-D2 when I was in a wheelchair, or calling me the bionic woman when I walked around with my leg brace that I still wear today, I didn't take it in as much anymore because I realized that I had survived. And the other big thing for me was I realized that as mean as they were to me, I would never wish my accident on them. And that really was very healing to me.
Yeah.
Also, my mother told off a priest at school, and that was very healing as well.
I bet. But it sounds like
They didn't call me or visit me.
Huh.
And my mother went in, and the priest said, "How is he doing?" And my mother said, "Well, he's doing fine and this and that, but he's disappointed that none of you ever came to visit, and you never even took the time to phone him." He said, "Well, Clinton, who, that's my real name, Clinton is in our prayers. And my mother looked at him and said, Clinton doesn't need your prayers. He's got enough good people praying for him. And she said, and I know damn well, if it had been one of those boys in those photos you've got behind your desk who were like the football and basketball stars of the school, she said, you would have been at that hospital every single day. And she picked up my books and stormed out of that school.
Yeah.
And then she thought, I'm going to hell. I just told off a priest. Yeah. I was thrilled. I was thrilled.
I was just going to say, and like, yay, mom, because like she's actually getting to express the real anger of that moment. Yeah. And what's interesting, the kind of note that I want to make about that too, is that what you're describing through a lot of not just really difficult times, but also traumatic experiences through being bullied, like severely bullied just for being who you are, for any bit of sexual assault that you've experienced, for landing on glass and having a physical trauma that happened. These things, as they happen, we find ways of surviving, and our brains function in ways where it helps to survive so we can just move through our lives beyond that point. And part of the way that that does that is it starts to kind of create a rift between the different parts of our brains functioning. So we might not necessarily then have the same level of access to the emotional parts of our functioning. And so that's what helps us kind of function. Like you said, you were able to just kind of move along, and your mom at one point is even kind of picking up the slack, knowing that that needs to be expressed, and is kind of like charging, you know, at the priest even. And being able to do that. So I love all the ways that you're talking about how you've been able to survive. And I'm curious for you, in your journey kind of beyond that point, in what ways have you been able to actually thrive? In what ways have you been able to maybe kind of reintegrate the different parts of your brains and the feelings and emotional parts of your processing in life?
That's such a good question, Matthew. I love you so much.
Thank you, Alec.
This is why I love doing the show with him. He's so good. That's such a great question.
Yeah. Well, it was a lot to take in.
Yes.
And even as you were saying all of that, I felt myself detaching. Isn't that amazing?
Oh,
not because I didn't find it interesting, but I think I was like, whoa.
Yeah.
But one of the wonderful things is, again, in relation to the accident, was also my dad, and I knew he loved me, but I didn't necessarily get along with him all that well.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I kissed him goodnight every night, kissed both my, you know, but I was just different. Mm-hmm. And when I had the accident, my father started to become a father again. Now, my parents had lost a child when I was 3 months old. My sister, Kathy, died when she was 15. Mm. And so this was traumatic for them because I was around the same age when she died. They thought they were losing another child.
Oh, wow.
So when I survived it, they really became, we became more like a family again.
It sounded like they were aware of how precious. Yeah, it sounded like the almost losing you reminded them of how precious you were. And it in turn kind of it made them more advocates on your behalf. They saw the value of your life in ways that they hadn't before. And you told an interesting thing on stage when you finally put on your wig as Miss Coco. They had an experience looking at you. Can you tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. I showed them me for the first time as Coco, which they were both like, oh, you know, by that point they were like, it figures, you know, because I was always carrying on and being silly. So I showed them myself as Coco, and they both were kind of horrified and shocked and saying like, oh my God, holy shit. And I thought they were a bit freaked out that I was wearing women's clothes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not what happened. My mother said, oh my God, you look just like your dead sister's ghost.
Wow.
Isn't that trippy, Matthew? That is trippy.
I didn't know whether to laugh or to give a horrified response, because I felt so many things in that.
Yeah. Miss Coco, she makes you laugh and she horrifies you at the same time. Here's the thing I love about you, Coco. Let me say one really, you know, it's like so much of your comedy is really about, you have this recurring punchline where you say, in your solo shows, where you say, am I bitter? Absolutely. Yeah. And it always gets a huge laugh. But the truest thing about you in our conversation today is that you do have so much forgiveness in your soul as a part of who you are in order to move on. What I'm hearing a lot of today and what empowers you and is really inspiring is the amount of forgiveness you have for the people who have, you know, abused you and made your life difficult.
Yeah, I think when you have when you live authentically, and as I created Coco, and Coco was like the biggest healing thing I could have ever done for myself, because I just decided to embrace everything I'd been taught to hate about myself and just celebrate it. And once I felt that liberation, and once I felt like I was a two-spirited person, and now we have the word non-binary, but once I could accept all of that about myself, and I found my voice again, and putting on women's clothes, but still acknowledging that I'm male, just rooted me. And I felt powerful for the first time in my life. And I realized I could walk around with my head held high. And that sort of liberation was something that I wanted every LGBT kid to experience. I didn't want them to have to go through the shame and the everything. So that's when I decided I'm going to be this two-spirited modern day drag queen who's going to save the world. You know, that was my ridiculous kind of mission statement at the beginning. But truly, that was it. And so when you live authentically, you have, and you feel liberated and you feel blessed, holding resentment against people doesn't help you. What helps you is pushing forward and creating the change, creating the world that you want to live in and that you want to see for future generations. And I do just want to also mention that although I may seem whatever, what you just said, Alec, I also 2 years ago decided to put myself on Lexapro. And I'm just curious, Matt, I had read somewhere, and I don't know if you ever read this, but that people who have near-death experiences often come back with a very, that justice is very important to them, and that seeing an injustice, it just literally, I become obsessed. I feel like this hole in my chest. And so what happened was, I'm very sensitive to litter and how we treat the earth. And I was on a beach in Spain, and two young people threw cigarette butts into the Mediterranean, and I went there. I lost it. And my husband was so mortified. He said, "You need help. You can't live like this." Also, as a performer, our job, Alec, you know, is to make other people feel what we feel.
Yes.
So I make everybody around me feel what I'm feeling. And that 24/7, I think, can be quite intense for the people we love. And so my doctor explained it beautifully. He said, artists, most people live here, like in this middle ground, and artists have these highs and these lows, which are wonderful because they give the rest of us who don't know those, you give us a glimpse into that world. He said, but we're just going to pull it down, up and down a little bit. We don't want you to lose all of that, but we also don't want you suffering. And so I decided, for the sake of my marriage, really, and here's the thing, I thought I was completely normal. I still think in many ways my behavior is normal for me. And I'm often outraged that other people aren't as outraged as I am about the injustices in the world. But at the same time, I somehow needed to not be so consumed by it that it, you know, it affected everyone else around me.
Well, Coco, let me just say this too, because it does make sense. The intensity of feeling that you have is absolutely normal and totally justified and does make sense. Maybe sometimes there are certain ways that we kind of like over-exaggerate certain things that are going on outside of us. But especially when we've had a long history in our lives of trauma and we've had to dissociate more from the emotional stuff that we might be feeling within us, we then can project out and process a lot of what we're feeling on what's going on outside of ourselves because it feels safer. So when we're seeing people litter and the injustices of the world, it's not just, you know, anger, it's rage because we haven't been able to process a lot within ourselves of what's going on. So that makes sense.
That makes perfect sense.
That makes so much sense, Matt. And in fact, years ago, I started my show off wearing a hat that had an emblem on it that said rage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because that's what I felt so much.
Yes.
You know, Absolute rage.
I think the theater is a wonderful place to be able to address that rage, have a good laugh about it. And I often do feel much more, I feel more elevated as Coco than I do as myself. I feel like I'm more evolved as Coco than actually myself.
I love when you said, I felt normal, because I've been on Lexapro for about 3 years. When I was talking to my psychiatrist, there was a certain level of despair and hopelessness that I had learned to live with. That I knew that at some point during the year, I was going to have 6 weeks where I felt like everything was hopeless and I was going to give up. Absolute despair. But what was happening to me was those moments of despair were getting closer and closer together. Like, it wasn't just like over in the future. It was like it was becoming a regular thing. And so I didn't take meds for a long time because I thought that's just how I was supposed to feel. But now I feel everything. I feel all my emotions. I'm not numbed out. I feel sad, but it doesn't go to hopelessness. That's the biggest difference for me.
That's exactly my experience now. And I've often felt as though I look at people who have children, like you, Alec. I don't know about you, Matt, but and I think I don't have children, and yet I sometimes care more about this planet and what I'm leaving the future generation than what I witness around me often. And I guess that's when I start to feel hopeless, is that... when you don't feel like other people care as much as you do.
I know.
Thank God for Lexapro, because it has made me be able to function and still celebrate this journey that we're on, rather than just feel like, oh, why bother?
Well, personally, I can tell you, based on my own experience of you, and, you know, because I knew you as a performer first and then we became friends, but there were things you said on stage when I saw you in the 90s that have stayed with me, where it was like when you said you have to embrace the things you were taught to hate about yourself. That was a huge light bulb moment for me as a queer person.
Great.
It's kind of, we're always running away from that. We're always running away from the shame. And then when you finally look at the things and you see that there's nothing to be ashamed of, I'm not so bad, then it's like, it's life changing. So, and I've also seen the people, the audiences filing out of your shows. They're so happy. You elevate people. So when you're feeling sad about those things, know that you have made an enormous difference.
Well, thank you. And that has been the best part of YouTube, is that I've reached this whole new generation of people who love that. I don't care what other people think of me when I'm walking through a Kmart.
Yeah.
Because I may not fit in, but I'm owning my right to be there.
I love that.
And young people love it. And they see, like, you know, they ask, can I call you Aunt Coco? Can I call you Grandma? It's because they are looking for role models of people who live authentically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, I have to say,
includes the good and the bad of me, honestly.
Yeah, all of it, because it's all of it that we want to accept. We don't want conditional love. We want the unconditional love for all of the parts of what makes us human. But I have to say this before we wrap up for our show, because, as you know, especially as we're talking about some of the things that maybe young people today have said to you. But when I came out in 1999, which is exactly when Trick came out. And so I got to see that movie. I got to see you in that movie. And any time that I'm hearing anybody talk about Come in Their Eyes, I always think of you and how much it burns. And I just have to say, it's kind of like, you are for sure like one person, one image that comes to mind at the very start of my coming out. So you were very much that to me. You very much embody kind of that moment in my life. So I just want to say thank you for that, because that was such a huge moment for me too.
Thank you, Matt. And that is exactly what, you know, I achieved my goal then.
There you go.
All I can say.
Well, we always wrap up the show with a hot message from our guest. And when you're talking about young people today, do you have a particular message to young people that you feel like they need to hear right now, to young queer people?
Yes. One of the things that I find is that when I go for instance, to Starbucks dressed as Coco. I will say most of the people are nice to me. Some guys flirt with me. People engage in conversations with me that I never would have had. And so I tell young people, there's a couple of things I tell young people, is that living outside the box is where the magic happens. Mm-hmm. And that you get to create your life, not all these roles that society set up for you. So step out of the box and really discover who you are. Yeah. Always make your goals bigger than your fears.
Yes. Yes.
And when someone looks at me and says, here's your coffee, sir, I don't take it in. I think how sad that they had to do that. That says something more about themselves. Mm. And I notice a lot of young people sometimes feel victimized if people don't, you know, choose not to call them by their proper pronoun or choose to, you know, we can request that of people, but if they feel as though they want to be mean to us, all I can say is that's their problem. Mm-hmm. Don't take it in. And you don't have to change those people. Focus on yourself. Don't let those people have power over you. Mm-hmm. Don't let them victimize you. Just forgive them and say they must be very sad that they can't find it in their heart to have some sort of just human relation with me. And so that's the way I deal with the mean people.
See, she's the drag queen is going to save the world. Where can people find you? Where can people find you on your socials, Coco?
CocoPeru.com is my website. And then, of course, I'm on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter. I haven't started TikTok yet, but who knows?
What's your handle? What's your handle on those socials?
Miss Coco Peru.
Oh, easy peasy.
Miss Coco Peru, thank you so much for being on the program today.
Thank you, Coco.
And I'm so sorry my dog snored through your near-death experience.
Yeah, it's all right.
Nothing personal. She's an animal.
I forgive your dog. I'm not taking it personally.
There you go. Love it.
That love bitch. You. I'll talk to you soon. Bitch.
Bye.
Bye.
We've all seen the headlines in the news of how someone lost their life in an act of cold-blooded murder. And while it's sad and grabs your attention, most people go on with their day without giving it another thought. But have you ever stopped to think about the life of the person at the center of the news story? They were more than just a headline or a statistic. They were someone's loved one or friend. I'm Mike Morford, and my podcast, The Murder of My Family, dives into some of those stories to help listeners get to know the person who was lost and how their death affected those closest to them. Listen to The Murder of My Family everywhere you listen to podcasts. There are well over 100 episodes to binge on now.
What a great show, Matthew.
Such a great show. I loved it.
Yeah. It's so great seeing you. This was like, we've both been busy and we've had to skip a couple weeks. So it's a real treat for me to have some FaceTime with you. What's your hot message? What's your takeaway from this day?
Well, I think I just want to say this, almost a little bit of a PSA for trauma, is it's a lot more common than I think a lot of people might assume, because it's not really talked about too much because it seems like a very heavy thing. But just know that if you are experiencing any trauma or have experienced any trauma, you are absolutely not alone. And there's tons of treatments for it, and very specific trauma treatments for it that can help us kind of reprocess a bit of some of the things that we, because of survival, needed to detach from, but so that we can find a little bit more of a flow and we can still kind of go out into the world and feel the magic, as Coco says, and bring it back to the people.
That's great. My message is it's not normal to feel despair all the time. Yeah. there's an alternative to it, and it doesn't make you weak to get help. If you advocate for yourself that you deserve a life where you're not feeling those feelings at all, where if you're advocating for yourself that you want to feel joy, you want to feel greater energy, that's perfectly all right. Totally. My big boy, my big sturdy boy who can get hit by a car and survive, where can people find you on your socials?
You can find me on Instagram and Twitter at MJ Dempsey Psych, and Facebook, Matthew J. Dempsey Psychotherapy.
I felt like you were about to say something that I cut you off.
I was just going to say only, no, because only you said it's not normal to, you know, to be feeling a lot of the whatever you said. And it's such a nuanced thing, but I feel like I have to say it. It is normal for a lot of people to be feeling those things.
All the time.
And it is normal, meaning it's common, and a lot of people do struggle with these things. And also there are opportunities to be able to process through that and get support and help so that that does not have to be your normal.
Okay. So by saying normal, I'm like, if you feel sad all the time, you're a fucking weirdo.
Right. Well, yes, because then you're implying to something abnormal. And I know you didn't mean that, but you know,
I didn't listen.
Words are important.
Sad people out there, sadness is normal, but I was feeling so sad all the time. Hopelessness all the time that I needed help. Yes. So I'm not normal. So
no, you are normal. And there's hope normal. For everybody.
Yes. And there's hope for everybody. You can find me at Alec Mappa on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook. And you can find us both at Stage 29 Podcasts on Instagram and the Twitter. We love hearing from you. And for those of you who have written in to us, thank you so much for listening. We're so grateful that you tune in and that our audience is growing week after week after week. That tune in next week for more Hot Mess Fun. We'll see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye, guys.
This podcast has been produced by Stage 29 Productions for entertainment purposes only. The contents of this podcast does not constitute medical or professional advice, do not reflect the opinions of this company, any of its parent companies, affiliates, subsidiaries, promotional sponsors, or advertising agencies. The views expressed by the hosts and guests are their own, and their appearance on the program does not imply an endorsement of them or any entity they represent. For more information, please go to stage29.tv.